So before we start, I'm actually going to read out a tweet that you did. And then we are going to ask you a question around that because it was actually very interesting. And I have to look at my notes here. So you said virtual machines are like cities.
Yeah.
Once a city like NYC gets big enough, it's like a magnet. Even if it has significant issues, people move there by default. Newer cities can get a lot of growth, but unless there's something revolutionary, the new cities are unlikely to displace the OGs. Very cool. So why do you believe in this statement at a macro level? Like forget blockchain, forget Web3. Why did you say this?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the reason I said it was tied to virtual machines on chain, but I think fundamentally, like, I've spent time living in cities like New York, San Francisco, and it continues to kind of confuse me why so many people want to live in places like that. Because there's all these like structural things that are wrong with these cities. Like in the case of like SF, for example, there's a ton of problems with like safety. There's a lot of like homelessness. In New York as well, I think that there's a lot of like things tied to, for example, congestion. Like there's crowds everywhere. And I kind of thought a little bit more deeply about it. Like, why don't these cities get displaced? There's like all these newer cities that are getting more and more investments. Why don't people just move there instead? And I mean, fundamentally, it's because these old cities, they're like magnets. That's where all the activity is happening. That's where everyone already is. And it's really difficult to get someone else to join, like to basically go to a new city instead of one of those older cities. So I noticed that trend. I think it's definitely true for crypto as well. Like once you have a virtual machine like the EVM, once there's enough mindshare around that, it's really difficult to displace it.
That's great, man. Yeah, totally agree on that. So Jay, I actually have a question about, you know, the background that you had before crypto. You were at Robinhood, and that's a huge shift, right? So why did you start building in Web3 in the first place?
So my time at Robinhood, I would say, was pretty interesting. When I interviewed there to join, this was like back in 2017, it was two houses across the road from each other in Palo Alto. Like in one of the houses, they literally took the bedrooms and they had like standing desks over there for the engineering teams to work from. So that's what it was like when I interviewed. And I was there for a few years. So I saw everything play out. I saw 10X, I saw the IPO happen. And I was also there when the GameStop saga went down with Robinhood. So for anyone that might not remember, there were around a dozen meme stocks that retail was like getting super excited about. And basically the price for these stocks was just going straight to the moon. And then one day out of the blue, Robinhood just turned off buys. And that was from someone that was trading, from someone that was on Wall Street Bets. From that viewpoint, it was just extremely surprising. Like, why would Robinhood do this? Because when you turn off buys, that effectively stops the price from going up higher. And it felt kind of just like there are two dudes in a room that are calling the shots and they're like, okay, we're going to turn off buys to help traditional, like these institutional players that are shorting the stock. And I mean, honestly, that was infuriating. I think anyone that was on Wall Street Bets at the time, they were just extremely mad about that. And as an insider, like all of my friends were asking me questions around like, yo man, what's happening? Like, why is all this stuff going down? And you're like, you just feel so powerless when something like that is going down because people are coming to you with questions and you don't really have anything to be telling them. So that was actually the original inspiration. We wanted to build something like Robinhood, except build it on-chain. That then led us down this entire journey where this was back in 2021. So we're like, okay, which chain should we build it on? And there wasn't really any chain that was performant enough to support that. So then we're like, okay, let's go ahead and build our own layer one to support that. Ultimately, that's turned into what is now Say. So Say is the first parallelized EVM. And yeah, I mean, we went live with the parallelized EVM earlier this year. And since then, the traction has just been up and to the right.
That's such a great story. So tell us a little bit more about why is Say important for the growth of DeFi in this particular time?
Yeah. So over the past few years of building, there's one core thesis that we've built up, which is that the EVM, which is the Ethereum virtual machine, is here to stay. So the EVM is what Ethereum initially came up with. And that's the execution environment that they use to process transactions. It's like if you submit a trade to Uniswap because you want to buy some meme coin, The EVM is what's used to process that transaction. And at this point, around 85 to 90% of developer activity happens on the EVM. So there was a report put out by Electric Capital at the start of this year. A16Z put out a similar type of report earlier this year, where basically all developer activity is happening on the EVM. And that's because it's like that's what all the mindshare has been tied to over the past several years. So it's exceptionally difficult for a new virtual machine, for example, Solana C-level runtime or the Move VM, to come and displace that. So the EVM is here to stay. The question then becomes, what is missing from the EVM right now? And that's what we really spent a lot of time thinking about. And the answer to that is a lack of throughput is the biggest limiter for the EVM. So if you have, so throughput is basically how many transactions you can process per second. If you look at Ethereum L1, if you look at any of the rollups on L2 Beat, you're not really able to get more than 50 transactions per second that are able to get processed. Now, this results in two issues. The first is that from a user standpoint, this leads to really high gas fees. Like if you go and try to trade and there's 1,000 users that are all trying to submit transactions per second, but there's only 50 transactions that can fit in the block per second, then in that case, like you basically have a bidding war where you have to keep increasing how much money you're willing to pay to get included in the block. And this results in things like what you would have seen earlier this year with 100 Gwei per unit of gas. And the end result is if you're spending like $50 or $100 to get your transaction included, that's it. That's like no one can really do that. That just prices out most of the human population from trading on-chain. So I think that's one part of it. The other part is a much more restricted design space for developers. Like if you're a dev and you're trying to build an application, in Web2, you basically have an open canvas. Like if you look at the biggest Web2 applications, Google, for example, needs around 100,000 transactions per second. Building something like Google is just completely impossible to do on-chain right now, because you can only do it with like, you only get like 50 transactions per second right now. So you really have to take shortcuts to make it work on-chain. And an example of this would be the concept of an automated market maker. Automated market makers like Uniswap, they do not exist in traditional finance, but they exist in crypto because they fit the limitations of what the EVM allows for. So that's why we decided to increase the throughput for the EVM, more specifically by adding in parallelization. So when the EVM was initially built, they really just wanted to build a smart contracting blockchain. Like that wasn't really a concept before the EVM. They didn't really have as much of a focus on performance. And I think back then they were also like running out of money. So there was this like big push to just get it shipped. And then afterwards, we'll get, like think about performance. What we realized is the only way you can really facilitate applications like Google getting built on chain is by improving the throughput to be significantly higher. And one way of doing that is just by taking advantage of the hardware that people are already using to run these machines. Like the laptops that we're using for this conversation, phones that people like watch TikTok on. These are all machines that have multiple cores on them. So they're capable of processing multiple work streams at the same time. So it's bizarre that with the EVM, you're not really taking advantage of that. And that was the kind of insight that we had. So we started parallelizing the EVM, and that helps us get roughly 100x improvement on throughput right now, compared to what you get with the vanilla EVM.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible work, man. So how do you see the broader Ethereum ecosystem in the next 5 years?
Yeah, so we went live with the parallel EVM on mainnet in July of this year. That's when it was open for public use after the network upgrade had happened. And once it became clear that everything was working on mainnet, there started to be a lot of requests from external teams that wanted to work with Say Labs to basically get advantage of a parallel EVM for their own use case. Because like, if you think about it, like you're trying to build an app chain, or you're trying to build your own kind of general purpose rollup, why would you pick a slow chain over a fast chain? Like there's literally no reason to ever pick that. If you have the choice between 5,000 TPS and 50 TPS, all things being held equal, you will pick 5,000 TPS all the time. So that's one thing that we started noticing, and that was kind of the impetus for the parallel stack. The parallel stack is basically a way for anyone that's trying to build their own infrastructure to benefit from a parallel EVM. So what we see happening in the longer term is there's going to be anyone that needs performance for their app chain, they'll start making use of of the parallel stack to create their own kind of parallel EVM-based execution layer. And then they'll use some kind of alternate DA layer to have the kind of performance that they're looking for.
So Jerry, for founders to pivot fast in this space, and also what have you as a, you know, sort of a new Web3 founder in the past few years?
That's a great question. So we are a Silicon Valley team. We got started in San Francisco, and one of the core lessons that you kind of hear from like Y Combinator or from like anyone you talk to in Silicon Valley is to ship fast and then iterate quickly. And basically just get something out there, get user feedback, and be able to tweak your product based off what people that are using it actually say. Surprisingly, this is not the approach that like 90% of teams in crypto take. I think in crypto, people don't really value customer feedback as much. I honestly don't know the answer for that. I have hunches around why that is the case, but I think in crypto, it's very much a slower kind of development lifecycle and user feedback isn't considered as much. And I think that's a massive mistake. Like you're really just kind of shooting yourself in the foot and doing yourself and your users a disservice if you're going to take a very long time to ship something and then aren't really able to act on user feedback. So in our case, we went live with like V1 of Say went live August of 2023. And after launch, it became very clear that it was difficult to get developers to build on Say because Say only supported Cosmos Blossom. So V1 of Say was only a Cosmos Blossom ecosystem. And after Terra collapsed in 2022, there really weren't new Cosmos Blossom developers that were entering crypto at all. Like Terra was a Cosmos Blossom based chain. And then after Terra collapsed, Cosmos Blossom kind of lost relevance pretty quickly. So that's why we're like, oh shit, okay. User feedback is very clear. They don't want Cosmos Blossom. They would prefer to use the EVM because that's what everyone is using already. That's what led us to kind of investigating how we can support the EVM in Say. So yeah, I think high-level answer to your question is it's incredibly important to value user feedback. And if you're not iterating as quickly as you can, I think that there's just something that is structurally wrong with the way that you're approaching building a company. Because I think most startups that ship slowly, there is something that they're doing wrong internally that will kind of hold them back.
In crypto, they also pivot fast, but only on the nerd part. No, actually on the product part.
Actually true.
Yeah. You know, but it's great taking the Silicon Valley product building, pivoting, you know, YC shop to actual product building in Web3. That's super, super awesome. What was the most challenging decision you've made so far as a founder, I'd say?
That's a good question. I think going forward with going from being Cosmos Blossom only to being Cosmos Blossom plus EVM, like that switch from V1 to V2, it was a pretty difficult decision because the entire time that we'd been building Say before then, we were really focused on one thing, which was supporting Cosmos Blossom. And then after getting that user feedback, it's tough to pull the trigger and be like, okay, we need to start supporting EVM. We need to start making all these changes. Because there's no way, you don't know if it's going to be working, right? Like it could be perceived and received very well by the developer community, but alternatively, they might also not really care and it could also end up being a negative thing. So I think that was the hardest decision specifically. I think the hardest time for us overall was probably the seed round that we ended up raising. Because when we initially got started building, we decided to raise our seed round in May of 2022. Which if you all remember, that was like right when Terra collapsed. So like we started raising a few weeks after Terra collapsed and our timing there was impeccably bad because that's when most VCs were just like trying to take a step back, see if like crypto is even going to continue being relevant a few months in the future. That's when we like went out to raise. So I think that was really, really difficult. And I think we ended up getting quite lucky that Multicoin was willing to take the contrarian bet of being around the table and helping us out. Because I think back then, most VCs were either not interested in us or they wanted to kind of just see how things played out from the sideline. So yeah, it's been quite the journey since then.
That's very cool, man. Yeah, this tech stack selection actually panned out really well for you guys. Super, super cool. As a founder, how do you measure success personally for your team and also for Say?
So this is something that I've been doing a lot more reflection on, definitely in the past year. So I think for me personally, I measure success as like just being excited by what I'm working on. Like if I'm excited by what I'm doing, then I think I'm making good use of my time. And I think that in a way that is success. From the team side, I think the ability to execute and ship quickly is the most important thing. That I think is the core output that any team has. Like there's a lot of different inputs that go into that, like the interview process, how much time people are investing into that. Like I would say even like morale is like one of the inputs that determine like how quickly a team is able to like ship something. So I think if a team is able to ship quickly, that is the single most tangible output you can look at to see whether the team is executing well or not. So that's kind of what we look at the team level. And when I look at kind of Say as a protocol, I think that there's a lot of different kind of metrics that you can look to. Some of them would be more financial metrics like TVL or volume of activity. There can also be metrics tied to user growth, like daily active users, for example. I think all of these metrics can be gamed to an extent. Like if you care about daily active users, then people can write scripts to just increase the number of daily active users. So I think it kind of ends up being a more nuanced aggregate kind of thing where you look at all these metrics that might matter, both from the developer activity side, also from any financial activity happening on chain, and then use that to see whether there's trends that you're seeing. But I think if you just spend time on Twitter, like it's a very easy kind of litmus test where when there's like a ton of excitement from the community, like you see that very, very tangibly. So I think that might be a softer way of measuring that.
What do you think Web3 founders can learn from Web2 success in the past? Because you have both.
Yeah, I mean, we already talked about building and shipping quickly. One thing that I think I really needed to understand is that people in positions of authority, they are not necessarily people that know everything. So like more tangibly here, if you go out to raise a round and there's a lot of investors that turn you down, that is kind of the default scenario for most projects that end up becoming successful. I don't think that that's something you should really be too demoralized by. And I think it's very easy. Like when you're like high school, college, like all these things, it's kind of like people in positions of authority, they determine what grade you get. They determine how successful you are. But when you start building a business, it's not really that way at all. Like if some well-known investor turns you down, that doesn't really mean anything because most of the time they're not investing in top tier. Like if there's like 10 projects that make it, there's a very good chance they ended up not investing in those projects. And a lot of the projects they do invest in, they don't end up making it. So I think having too much morale tied to investors that are supporting you, I think that's not something that you should really do as a Web3 founder. And I think in Web3, it's even more variable than in Web2. Like if you look at SaaS companies in Web2, if you're building like software as a service, I think it is much more formulaic. So I think it might be easier for a VC to be able to invest well. But I think in crypto, it's like more about community building. And I think that's a very kind of ambiguous thing that it's difficult for investors to accurately gauge.
Yeah, there's definitely some contrarian type of thinking that can be good here. That said, I wanted to ask you about memes. What's your view? I mean, I think you guys are super technically proficient. You know, you build real tech. There's also some memes on Say as well. So then how do you use, what's your view on that? And also what's your view for that phenomenon?
Yeah, so my initial view for memes came from GameStop, which we're talking about before. And it's really interesting because I think for that, it was kind of like this entire community movement. Like it wasn't just like people didn't just want to like make money. It was more like this entire like fighting against the traditional financial system. And I think in the case of GameStop, it really was kind of like an FU to whatever happened with like the financial crisis where like banks got bailed out by taxpayer money. I think a lot of people were really unhappy about that. And GameStop to me was a movement where they were kind of fighting against that. And I think that is one thing that meme coins can be. They can be part of something bigger. They can be part of a movement. And I think that's what makes it particularly exciting. Like it's not just like speculating. I think it can be being part of a bigger community. In terms of what's happening in crypto right now, I think we see both things. We can see things like what Murad was doing with like, I think it was called SPX 6900 was the name of the coin that he was talking about, where it does kind of start to feel more like this massive kind of community vibe in a way similar to like NFTs, except even bigger because you can have larger ecosystems that grow from it. And on the other hand of it, I think there is just like pure speculation happening around that as well. I think the pure speculation will continue. I think it'll be like each individual token will have like some speculation, then afterwards that token will die off. So I'm less excited about that. I think that's a good onboarding mechanism to like draw in people to experience crypto and then start trying out other things. I think the movement part of it is like what's more exciting to me. And I think over the next like year or so, there probably will be broader movements that start from this. So some of the one of the more recent metas that I think has been interesting to follow has been the crypto, like AI agent type of meme coins. So those ones, I think 2025 will be a time where they start getting even more kind of excitement around them. And I think what really matters for meme coins is having, like, it should be easy to trade these meme coins. And I think that's why a lot of it is taking off on Solana versus on Ethereum L1, for example. Because if it costs like several dollars for you to trade like a $5 position, it doesn't really make sense to do that. And that's why I think ecosystems like Say are going to be positioned really well for that. Because the cheaper the gas fees are, the more accessible it is to normal people.
Could you provide examples of specific Ethereum-based applications or industries that would most benefit from the parallel stack?
Yeah, I think trading in DeFi would be one of the most clear ones. Especially like we were talking about like meme coins before. If you're like a 18-year-old person that has like maybe $1,000 in their bank account, you go to buy like $20 of a meme coin. If you have to pay like $15 in transaction fees, it just doesn't make any sense to be doing anything on chain. So it, like you really get priced out from doing anything in like this low TPS type of environment. So I think anything where you want to be submitting more transactions like benefits quite a bit from that. Some of the things that we've seen on Say, I'll mention one project, which is Bancor. They launched Carbon DeFi on Say, which is like, it's not exactly an order book DEX, but it's like order book style DEX. And they've launched on Say, and they've launched, I think, on 7 or 8 other ecosystems. Say is the ecosystem where they've been able to get the most activity happening because of the cheaper gas fees. That's also where they've ended up having the most volume as well. And Say's been like, this is just an aggregate. So they've only been on Say, I think, for like 5 months or something now. And they've already got more activity and volume than other ecosystems where they've been on for like a year or a year and a half at this point. So yeah, I'm really excited to see that play out even further in the future.
With some L2s or layer 2s already achieving high TPS, what competitive edge does the parallel stack offer to developers and projects?
Well, I'd make the argument that there's not really any L2 that is using Ethereum for data availability that is getting high throughput right now. So like if you go to L2 Beat and you just look at max TPS, there's not really any L2 that is, I think there's a couple that have gone past 50 TPS, but like there's not really any that is getting thousands or tens of thousands of TPS right now. And I think one of the fundamental limitations for those is like Ethereum DA, but I think also this like single threaded virtual machine is going to end up being a bottleneck even after that. So that's what the parallel stack really allows you to do. If you do support parallelism and if you move away from using Ethereum for DA, then you'll be able to get substantially higher throughput, which I think will unlock new use cases, especially if you're trying to build like your own type of app chain.
Are you planning to educate developers on the benefits of parallel processing, both within the Say ecosystem and also outside the Say ecosystem as well?
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't think developers really need that much education about parallelism. Like anyone that got a computer science degree, I think you inherently, like you've already been exposed to like several years where they teach you parallelism is a good thing. So I think it's pretty easy to like intuitively understand that like, oh, parallelism is a really good thing. I think this is like different from, for example, like Polygon Aglayer. I think it's much harder for there to be education. Like it needs a lot more work to educate someone about Aglayer than it would to educate someone about parallelism. Because I think parallelism is just something that like developers understand very intuitively. In terms of like how to get developer adoption, I think that's a much harder problem to solve because developers only want to go to ecosystems where they can end up winning. And it's difficult to have someone win. It's hard to make that kind of flywheel get started. Once you have an ecosystem like Solana or Polygon, it becomes much easier to get, like once there's a pump.fun or there's a Polymarket, it's easier to get new projects to come and start building that ecosystem. But I think that first spark of getting that initial killer app is probably the hardest part for any ecosystem to succeed.
Yeah, initially you mentioned the importance of, user feedback. I guess, what kind of initial feedback did you receive from Ethereum developers about the parallel stack?
The parallel stack hasn't been released yet, but I think there's just general excitement. From Ethereum developers in terms of building on the parallel EVM that Say has, I think it's been resoundingly positive so far because it allows them to get much cheaper fees, higher throughput. I would say the one part that's different about Say versus other chains is we support Cosmwasm and EVM. So there's this 0x address space for EVM, and then there's this like Say address space that was previously there. So I think that's something that takes some getting used to. But outside of that, I think it's been a pretty clean adoption process for them.
And can you walk us through what your strategy has been so far to like develop and grow the broader like Say ecosystem?
Yeah, so this is something that the Say Foundation spends a lot more time on. I think that there's different parts of the Say ecosystem. There's the developers, and then there's the actual community members. I think community members, it's interestingly been very organic. Around this time last year, Say didn't have much activity on the chain at all. And I think today we're recording. So actually, November 29th of last year is when we put out the Say V2 kind of blog post. And that's when there started to be a lot of just organic excitement. I think there were some people like Ansem, Hasaka, that got really excited about V2. And then they started tweeting about it. And then this led to a Saiyan meme that kind of got started with like Dragon Ball Z. And that led to the initial set of NFTs, initial set of meme coins that really got adoption on Say. So I think that community growth was largely organic. And I think it's really difficult to have like a playbook to do that well. That's why like when you see a project, like I would say Monad is one example here, it's been able to get this like really significant community built up. I think that tends to be pretty exceptional. Like it's really difficult to do something like that. From more of a developer standpoint, I think that there are several initiatives that the foundation is doing. They're like working very closely with talented developers. They're giving grants. They're like helping from like marketing side as well to help these projects succeed.
Wait, so do you guys have like a community engagement program or some kind of a community program where that's all been pretty organic?
I would need to check with the foundation. I do think most of it has been pretty organic though.
Got it. Do you see opportunities for developers to build cross-compatible solutions between, say, and Ethereum?
That's an interesting question. So from a technical side, I think it's definitely feasible. I think it's more a question on the UX and go-to-market side, whether that ends up being better. I am a little skeptical of the kind of this roll-up-centric app chain type of roadmap, where everyone gets their own chain and tries to interoperate with other chains. I think app chains where they're kind of isolated, like Hyperliquid would be one example here, like DYDX, that approach makes sense. But having something where it's like interoperating with like 10 other chains to try to do something, I think that increases the technical complexity of that infrastructure a lot. I think the user experience there is going to be worse. Like there's no user experience which can be better if you're in a multi-chain world. So I anticipate that that'll lead to, if you're communicating across 10 chains, that'll lead to greater latency because all these chains now need to communicate with each other. So like user perceived latency for like transaction to finalize will probably increase like maybe from 2 seconds, to like 20 seconds or something. So I think that's going to be a limitation. And then another part of it that I think is definitely important is like crypto in general is winner take most. And if you have these ecosystems like Solana or like Polygon where there's already a ton of activity happening, they don't typically want that activity to go to other chains. So they end up having all these primitives, all this liquidity in their own ecosystem. So I think it'll be difficult to move away from having everything in these ecosystems to a world where you try to get it from like other ecosystems as well. So I think that'll be one of the bigger friction points as well.
If you could achieve one milestone for Say, by the end of next year, what would you put your finger on?
Oh, the one thing that would make me incredibly happy is getting one killer application on Say. And I mean, I view of killer application as something like Pump.fun or like Polymarket. If we get one of those on Say, I think the ecosystem will just, it'll become significantly bigger.
Okay. And if a developer or a founder is listening to this, define a killer application on Say as specifically as possible.
That's a difficult thing to do as well. But I think something that that is able to result in a lot of new users coming on for like maybe the number of users we could say on the order of like hundreds of thousands of like organic users that want to come in to start using something Another aspect of it would be mindshare. Maybe Kaito would be one example over here where that application is able to get like top 20, 30 mindshare on Kaito. I think that'd be an example of a killer application.
Until now, which one do you think has been the most, which one has been the application that you're proud of?
So on Say so far, I think a lot of the activity has been tied to NFTs and meme coins. So I would say DragonSwap, which is the main DEX on Say, has been like where most of the activity has been. But I do think in the past few months, there's been several other projects in other ecosystems that I can look to and say, yeah, those guys have done a really good job. And I'd like something of that flavor to exist on Say as well.
Okay. Yeah, I think it kind of looks, it's a great vision, you know, and if you have, and you say that you've been growing like super fast and you've been pivoting fast. I mean, so much has changed like since we spoke last about what was happening on Say. How do the next 6 months look for you in terms of where are the numbers right now? How many dApps do you have? What are you doing to get more apps on Say? Do you have targets? And just if you have to list like 3 things that you do to achieve these targets, what are they?
Okay, lots of questions over there. So I think in terms of like what I would like the next 6 months to look like, I definitely want there to be more experimentation happening on Say. And I think one thing I've started seeing in the past month and a half to 2 months is more games that are actually launching on Say. So around a year ago, there really weren't any games that are launching. But recently we started seeing, like after the Apparel EVM went live, I think it became much easier for games to deploy. And they have been. And I think that's been one of the things that has been getting at least more activity happening on Say. In terms of like milestones and I guess 3 specific things. Yeah, I mean, that's probably a better question for the foundation. But I think in terms of like the type of support that the foundation typically offers, I think a lot of it just ends up being kind of direct one-on-one support that doesn't necessarily scale. So like rather than trying to support 100 different projects and doing a poor job of supporting all of them, what I've noticed is the foundation tends to just see, okay, there's these 5 or 10 projects that are like really, really strong. Let's just be really involved with them and help them succeed as much as we can. I think that doesn't really scale well at all, but I think that increases the odds of getting like at least one killer application that's built in that ecosystem.
I mean, honestly, I think that's a great approach because I think a big problem in Web3 right now is focusing on like huge numbers, whether it's like hackathons or projects or, you know, like ETH Global for that matter. And I was interviewing like DevRels for a story and I asked all of them that, you know, what is it that you look for now in terms of like what is stopping projects to go from like testnet to mainnet and what is it? So they said like there are 2 gaps. One is that the industry is focusing a lot on low quality projects rather than saying that, okay, we do one hackathon and even if we get one project, we are not going to focus on 800 submissions. And the second thing they said is like, it's a very vibe industry and there's no proper metrics to measure the success of a project from when they just started to they go till they go to mainnet, and nobody's keeping a track of it like very specifically. So I think that was interesting.
Yeah, I think that's really valid feedback. One thing that Kenzie mentioned was that narratives are often more important than like other things in the industry. And I, to an extent, I think that, I mean, first of all, I very strongly agree with that statement. But I also think that like tools like Kaito in the past, like I want to say like 9 months to a year, made it much easier to track mindshare. And like, that's something that like we definitely look at, which is like both for Say as a project itself, like how much mindshare we've been able to get. I think that generally ends up being a sign that like, there's some initiatives that are being taken that are beneficial. And I think that's also a way to measure like pre-launch projects, how much excitement they're able to get and like how much how much mindshare they're able to get as well.
And now we have some fun questions. I mean, I don't know, some people find these questions deep also, but we try to make it fun. So we are going to ask you that. Mm. Ready?
I think you've done this.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the one emotion that you have towards money? And What comes to your mind when you think of money and why?
Yeah, I mean, recently what I've realized is I don't actually care about money that much. I kind of view money as like I'm playing a game and that's kind of like the yardstick of success in that game in a way. Yeah, so I don't know the emotion tied to that, but I view it more as like a competitive thing.
Yeah, I think like my grandfather used to say that people who have money usually are the ones who don't care about it. So that also like solves, like once you have something, then it's not something that's your, whether it's health, money, or, you know, any of these necessities. But yeah, that's an interesting answer. If you could change one thing about the way money works today, what would it be? And I think your answer will be very interesting because you come from this background.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that is not great about money right now is there's decentralized entities that are like really driving a lot of it. I think if it was more decentralized in both the way that money is created and the way that it can be like kind of changed hands, I think that would allow for a lot more just like democratize the process in a much better way. And I think that it would prevent other people from being able to have control over you.
Yeah, that's what we all are working towards. Do you think trust is earned or designed?
So in an individual basis, I think it's different than like a protocol basis. I think from a protocol basis, it needs to be designed. Like it needs to be game theory optimal for people to behave correctly. And if it's not, then that protocol will not work.
What's the most misunderstood thing about the Ethereum ecosystem?
One thing that like, I feel like people just have this broader view that they move very slowly. They're not able to like really innovate and like bring that to some kind of conclusion state. And I think to an extent that criticism is fair, but I also think there's a lot of really talented people in the ecosystem that are able to individually move very quickly, come up with new ideas and try to get them out. I think it's just the kind of structural mechanisms that they've set up make it much harder to like bring those ideas to fruition. Like my mental model there is kind of like the Indian kind of government and like the bureaucracy over there. Like there can be individual actors there that are really, really talented and that are trying to move quickly. But if like structurally it's just difficult to move there, then I think it results in things moving a lot slower.
Yeah, that makes sense. What would you rather solve, scalability or security?
So I think of security as being like a thing where it's kind of binary, where it's like good enough. And then afterwards you can start focusing on other things. I think scalability is much more of like something where there is no end. Like it's not like 100 TPS is good enough or like 2000 TPS is good enough. So I definitely would like to solve scalability, assuming we're at a point where security is good enough.
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. Can't really choose between the two. What scares you the most about the future of crypto?
So, yeah, I mean, what I'm worried about for crypto is it being purely kind of a financial tool that's not able to get adoption. And what I mean by financial tool is like people launch tokens and the token is the product and no one really cares about anything else. Like that's not the direction that I want to see things being in 5 years. I feel like in the past, like whatever, 10 years, that has kind of been a large extent of it. I think there are blockchains that have been able to get adoption, but I think there's been too much of a focus on the token. So I'd really like to move away from that.
How do we do that? I mean, it's not a part of the questions, but it's just like, how can we four of us do our bit to help there, you know?
I think what'll really result in this happening is applications that work better on-chain than they do in a Web2 centralized way. And fundamentally, like blockchains still allow for verifiable compute between like parties that don't trust each other. And that's why I think like finance and like stable coins exchanges have all been one of the clearest examples where that has taken off. But I think if you're able to get other types of applications or like scale finance happening on chain, that will result in the token being less important and like the blockchain becoming more important.
What is one ethical principle for you, Jay, that you would never compromise on?
The way that I generally operate is I treat others the way that I would want to be treated. And I found that that's resulted in I mean, just a lot of good things, both in like interpersonal relationships and also more broadly with like the community, for example. So yeah, that's something I wouldn't want to move away from.
Yeah, that's really nice. And also like something we can apply. If you had a meeting with your younger self 10 years ago, what are you going to tell your younger version to do?
I mean, there's definitely personal things that I would tell them. From more of a purely like professional side, I think when I was quitting my job at Robinhood, I was very scared. And I didn't really have a good reason to be scared back then. Like I'd already been there for 3 years. I'd already like had a ton of learnings from that. But I was like just scared about the future, like uncertainty. And one thing that I realized is this uncertainty is just generally overblown. Like if you're living in like Silicon Valley, you have like this cushy tech job. If you quit your job, like the worst outcome is you'll still be fine. So I think I was like really unnecessarily scared about what could go wrong with that.
Okay, maybe this one is related, but was there like an epiphany or a moment when you know that, okay, now I just have to do my own thing? Was it like after Robinhood that it...
No, so I actually quit Robinhood to start what was initially like what ended up becoming Say. I think there was just like one day where I was like, okay, this is it. And this is like November of 2021, so a little over 3 years ago. I'm like, okay, I have to tell my manager now that I'm going to quit. And once I did it, that's when it really became real. Where I gave like a 3 or 4 week notice. I was like, oh shit, this is actually happening now. But yeah, it was kind of like just a spontaneous thing at the time. Like I'd been thinking about it for several months and I finally like ripped off the bandaid.
And okay, this is the last one. What is something that you had to learn after becoming a founder that was not something that was not like a skill or a quality that you had before?
I think managing is something that I had only done indirectly before. And I think it's something that's really difficult for new founders to do. And I think that kind of goes back to like that moral thing that I've been talking about before of like treating people how you would want to be treated. I think it's very easy to like treat people that are like employees as someone that you kind of have like control over. And I've seen like other founders that are like younger founders doing this. And that generally results in things not really working out well in the longer term. I think just trying to treat people well and like trying to understand their concerns proactively and like help address them goes a long way.
So you treat them how you would like to be treated.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is something I saw playing out at Robinhood, and Robinhood had really good retention. And that's one thing that we've been trying to emulate at Say as well.
Amazing. So this has been fun. I asked a lot of questions and it was great to talk to you again. And thanks Kenzie and Sachi also for joining, co-hosting and for your time, Jay. And thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back with another Web3 founder story very soon on Beacon Podcast.